Hi, everybody. I'm Danny Marsh. I'm an alcoholic. Yay. Hello. It is so cool to be in this room. I love this room. I get to see some friends who I've known for a really long time, and this room always makes me feel really safe and really welcome. And if you're new, I'm sure you're really thrilled for me. I'm sure you're like sweating crystal meth out of your spinal fluid and going. But I'm really happy for the chubby Jew at the podium. Really, I hope he has a good night, because. Excuse me. I'm sorry. I was in New York last week and I caught this little bronchial cold infection thing, and I'm like 3 days on antibiotics and inhalers and steroids, and so I could be done in about 4 minutes, or I could just pass out right here, or I could cough up a lung while I'm talking. It should be a really fun night. I want to thank Hillary for asking me to come and do this. It's an honor. It's an honor to leave my family on a Sunday night, really. It's the one night a week we get together to have dinner, because my daughter. It's funny. I haven't been here in a couple years, and I'll never forget, like, the first time I was here. I think my daughter was 2 or 3 years old, and she just turned 16, and it makes me feel old too, because I'm the same age I was when she was born, and she's 16 and she's still speaking to me, so it's a really big deal in our house. When she's not in a room by herself with her iPhone and her iPad and her laptop, going, who's this again? Who are you again? I need some money, and can you just take me to my friend's house? Because I'm really just an ATM and a chauffeur. But I'm really honored to be here, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. We were talking before the meeting about my late sponsor, and how lucky I was to find a family in Alcoholics Anonymous that welcomed a broken, dying, bleeding man and gave him a simple kit of spiritual tools and turned him into the guy that's standing in front of you today. And he did it with kindness and gentleness and ease, and he wasn't a bully, and he wasn't a mean guy, and he wasn't a, you gotta do this, and you better do that, and if you don't do this, and you gotta do, he was a guy who said, welcome to AA. You're safe, honey, in your home. So if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous and no one's welcomed you properly, welcome to AA. You're safe in your home. We need nothing from you. You don't got to do jack around here, right? If the best you can do is come to a meeting, and when you leave here, if you get loaded, if you could please come back again tomorrow until this magic starts to take effect on you, I welcome you. I get confused a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous with directions and being told what to do and how to do it and when to do it and all of that. And no one could beat me up more than I could beat myself up before I got here, right? I was such a big ball of shame when I got here that your punishment couldn't permeate the shame that I was killing myself with. And if you're new and you got that black hole of shame, welcome. You're safe. Your secrets are safe with us. And I take AA very seriously. I have this big, beautiful life that I shouldn't be having as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I take my sobriety very seriously. I'm a drunk, right? I drink. I was in New York, and I was flying back on Friday night, and there was a guy sitting next to me. Maybe he was about 30, 35 years old, and he drank. In the first hour of the flight, he drank 2 bottles of wine, right? The flight attendant just kept pouring him, and he just kept putting his glass out, and I really like that wine. Can I have more of that wine? And he's like drinking it like I drank it, right? And so I know what he's doing, and I'm counting the glasses, because I'm counting the glasses. And at one point, he's like, give me 2 glasses, and he's got 2 glasses sitting on the little thing that separate our 2 seats, and there's turbulence in the air, and he starts off off as this really nice guy, right? Nice to meet you, how you doing, blah, blah, blah. And then he puts his headphones on and he's intently listening to some music and he's drinking more wine and then he's headbanging and then he's like singing out loud in the plane and he's just going and the wine's like wobbling and I know, and I'm staring at the cup of wine, right? I'm staring at it because I know it's going to spill on me and then it's going to get ugly. And then all of a sudden he passed right out. Just passed right out. And that's my drinking career. That's the story of my drinking. I started off strong. I drank a lot really fast. And I petered out really early. And I spent 30 years doing that. Right? I drank and passed out. And I drank and I passed out. And I had big dreams when I drank and lofty goals. And I was going to get a lot of... I also smoked a lot of pot. And I hated pot. I hated it, but I smoked it every day for a decade. And I talk a lot about drugs, and I'm sorry if the talk about drugs offends anybody. In Bill's story, our founder's story, talks about Bill drank and drank and drank, and he couldn't stop drinking, and he went to a doctor, and the doctor gave him a sedative, and the next day found Bill taking both gin and sedative. So if drugs were good enough for our founder, they were good enough for me. And I did copious amounts for a really long time. I hated smoking pot. I felt like a puppy on linoleum. You know, it was like it was a lot of activity, but I never left like that little square in the kitchen. And I also really, really liked freebasing with hookers. It was one of the most fun things that I used to do, and I would still do it, but my wife frowns on that. And I periodically I miss that. A lot. I miss it a lot. So I understood this guy who was sitting next to me because I drank just like him. Right? And I drank and I couldn't stop drinking. And once I put alcohol in my system, all bets are off. I used to live around the corner from three of my favorite bars in the valley. And I would go to, one was called Stanley's, one was called Moonlight Tango, and one was called Prezo. And I'd get home from work and I'd say to myself, I woke up in the morning and I'd say to myself, I will not drink today no matter what. I will not drink today no matter what. And I got home from work and I thought, okay, I'll go to Stanley's and I'll have one. And I went to Stanley's and drank, and then I'd walk across the street and drink some more. Then I'd walk over to Prezo and drink, because I was a very sophisticated drinker. I was drinking double Grand Marniers. And then I'd walk down to the block to the restaurant where my Coke dealer worked. I'd buy an 8-ball, and I'd go home, and I'd do it all by myself. I really enjoyed peeking through curtains and looking under doorways till like 4:30 or 5 in the morning. It was one of the highlights of my cocaine use. I appreciated psychoses. I wasn't much of a party guy. Like, I did most of this stuff by myself. I periodically maybe would call an escort service because I like to date by the hour. And I found it far more convenient for me. And that's just how I drank. And if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous and you relate to any of that, welcome. And if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous and you don't relate to any of that, let me tell you that the source of all that is that I was really scared and I was really lonely and I was really tired and I had no clue how to live life on the planet the way you guys did. I believed way deep down inside that you guys were all given, like, the list, the rules, and I didn't get it. Because you guys seemed to navigate the planet so easily, and everything was so difficult for me. And I was an incredible people pleaser, and I could tell you everything I think you needed to hear so that you would become my friend, because I was so afraid and so tired of being alone. And if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous and you relate to any of that, welcome, you're in the right place. Because you are not alone. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley. That didn't cause my alcoholism. I came from normal parents. We had a lovely family. I had a baby brother, and then a little sister came along, and a mom and a dad. My grandfather was a rabbi in Hollywood. I was the first person suspended from Hebrew school under my grandfather's reign because they got tired of me smoking pot in the bathroom. And I had a pretty normal childhood. My first drunk was at my bar mitzvah. My grandfather was the rabbi on the pulpit in front of 1,800 of his closest congregants. I drank. I threw up on the pulpit before my bar mitzvah, my Torah portion. He was not as proud of me as I had hoped. And then we went to a party afterwards. We had a big party, and I drank all night, and I threw up on the guests, and I embarrassed my mom, and I embarrassed my dad, and I embarrassed his community. And the next thing I remember is the following morning going, you know, that really wasn't so bad. I could do this again. Like, I can, and that's the way I drank. Like, if you get between me and the drink, I will kill you. Like, nothing stands between me and the drink. And I don't care about your hopes for me or your dreams for me or your caring for me or anything that any of that means. If you get between me and the cocktail, I will kill you. I was talking to one of the guys I sponsor on the drive here, and we're going over, I was giving him some 6 and 7 step instructions because he had just finished this way too long inventory that like took for freaking ever. And I was really proud of him for the first 9 hours. And then I was thinking of giving him some other sponsees' phone numbers to finish. But we had just gone over some 6 and 7 step instructions, and we had a really nice talk, and we were talking about, he was talking about dating, and I suggested that he never do it again, and mainly because it would just be so much easier for me if he didn't, because I didn't want to hear about it anymore. And then I reminded him of how he drank, which is how I drank, which is, I will kill you to get to a drink. Right, I will kill you to get to a drink. And I was surrounded by people who had my best interests at heart and who only wanted to see me succeed and who only wanted to lift me up and go above and beyond. And I killed them to get to a drink or a drug. And when I was about 18 years old, I was drinking pretty good, and I was doing some drugs, and I was away with a girlfriend one afternoon, and I came home to find out that my little brother had died in a mountain climbing accident. And 3 weeks later, I was taking a walk with my dad at LA Valley College, and he dropped dead of a heart attack. And it sucked, right? It absolutely sucked, and it changed my life, and it ripped out like all that safety and security and comfort and understanding that I had known my whole life. And I went to the rabbi at the time, and I said, how do I wrap my head around this? How do I make sense about with all of this? And he said, I shake my fist at God. And I said, that's not good enough. That I got no connective tissue to that. There's no tethering me to that. And I crawled into another bottle of Jack Daniels. And I can tell you standing here that those experiences were life-changing and life-altering for me, they had zero to do with my alcoholism. Absolutely zero. Because if they did, I could go to a grief recovery seminar and freebase like a normal guy. And I can't. Like, I am bodily and mentally different from my fellas. I put alcohol and drugs in my sister, and I can't predict at all. I have a really good friend who I love who was sober for a little bit, and then he decided he was going to go to a bathhouse and drink. And he was drinking all night and in a bathhouse and doing whatever he's doing. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, he called his sponsor, and he said, I just need for you to know I've been drinking. I'm going to continue drinking tonight, and I'm going to come to a meeting in the morning. And his sponsor said, I have 2 questions for you, mate. He was English, and I don't have an accent. He said, first question is, are you alcoholic? And he said, yes, I'm alcoholic. And the second question is, what makes you think you have the luxury to decide when you can stop? And my friend heard that loud and clear. He walked out of the bathhouse. He went to a meeting, and he's been sober 23 years, right? So that's the kind of guy I am. I can't predict when I'm going to stop. So if you're new and you're lucky enough to have stopped, congratulations. It's the hardest part for me is to break that cycle of spree and remorse and replace it with the cycle of surrender and commitment. It's the most difficult task that I have. And I was gifted by a power greater than myself who separated me from a cocktail long enough to start to hear the music of Alcoholics Anonymous that eventually changed my life. So I drank, right? I drank and I drank. And I was in college in San Francisco, and I found a bar, and I developed this drink. It was Jack Daniels and peppermint schnapps on the rocks. Really? you guys are shooting heroin and you're making fun of my drink? Like, is that a little hypocrisy? Wow. That's so cool. But the bartender felt the same way, and he threw me out of the bar and refused to ever pour me that kind of drink because it was really gross, and I threw up on it a lot. But I love that you're willing to judge. Thank you. I ended up leaving San Francisco, and I ended up in a little apartment in Toluca Lake, and I tell this story often for two reasons. One, because I never want to forget what I was like before I got here, and two, because my wife is so embarrassed and hates when I tell this story, so I make sure I tell it all the time. Because, yes, I'm punitive. Yes, I am, and a bit retaliatory. And she can take that to her sponsor. So I end up in this little apartment in Toluca Lake, and my grandfather, not the rabbi, I had another grandfather who was a Russian immigrant, and he came to this country with nothing, right? And he learned the language, and he went to school, and he became a pharmacist, and he worked his ass off for a really long time to make a better life for his kids and his grandkids than the one he had when he was born. And when he died, when he had a heart attack, I was too loaded to go to the hospital. When he died, I was almost too loaded to go to the funeral. But when they were handing out the checks from the estate, I was first in line. And I went to my aunt's house, and she was scared of me at that point, and she handed me the check, and I went home, and I put it in the bank, and I called an escort service, and she came, and she brought a freebase pipe, and she stayed for 6 months. And I don't know about the rest of you men in this room, but when I ingest cocaine, my first thought is long-term Neanderthal sexual relations. The last thing that's humanly possible is for me to be an active participant. So if you can picture the short, fat, mulleted Jew waddling around his apartment with his underwear around his ankles, chasing a hooker for 6 months, getting absolutely nowhere, I had not heard the term pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I thought those were normal dating rituals, and my buddies who were in law school were not dating that way, right? It wasn't until I got here that I found out that some of you guys may have dated the same way. But what happened for me is that my grandfather spent 70 years building a better life for his kids and his grandkids, and I smoked it up with a hooker in 6 months. So if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know what that black hole is that you're bringing in. I don't know what that shame is that you're unwilling to set free so that you can walk the planet a free man, but that's what I brought to you. I was taking that to the grave, and that shame was going to kill me. When I was sober enough, the shame was going to kill me. And I drank to cover that shame for a long time after that. And I ended up in an apartment in West Hollywood with a buddy of mine. And I was doubled over in a whole bunch of pain, and I went to Cedars-Sinai emergency room, and they gave me a shot of Demerol, and they said, "Whatever you do, don't drink." And I said, "Oh, absolutely, sir," right away. And I went home, and I drank a fifth of vodka in my bedroom, because that's what I was drinking at the time, thrifty blue brand vodka, out of the bottle in my bedroom. I'd wake up in the morning, I'd brush my tongue, I'd throw up the vodka from the night before, I'd go back to bed, drink whatever was left in the bottle, turn on a Highway to Heaven rerun, and see where my day was going to go from there. So it wasn't as glamorous as it all looks now. And I ended up the next day going to a gastroenterologist, and here's where I start to understand how the disease of alcoholism manifests itself in me. I play by a different set of rules than anybody else on the planet, and whatever you citizens have to adhere to, I don't. I'm a little different, I'm a little special, and I can get away with a little more stuff than you can. So I went to a gastroenterologist, and I knew he was going to draw blood, and I believed to my innermost self he would not find alcohol in my system. And he drew the blood, and he came back, and he said, "Do you drink?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I have a glass of wine a night like anybody else." And he said, "It's noon, you have a 0.25 blood alcohol level." And I said, "Okay, two glasses." And he said, "You have a distended liver, and I'd like to check you into the hospital to detox your liver." And on my way to having my liver detoxed, I had an atrial fibrillation of my heart. They threw me into coronary care for 3 days, and then they shuffled me off to a chemical dependency unit. So when I tell you I came to Alcoholics Anonymous dying of alcoholism, it's not because it sounds good at the podium. My liver was that of a 55-year-old man, and I was 30 years old, and I had an atrial fibrillation of my heart, and I was almost dead because my detox from alcohol was so hard. And they sent me to this chemical dependency unit, and it was really lovely, and it was really sweet, and everyone loved me. And they were detoxing me with Ativan, and I really liked Ativan. It took the edge off a little bit. In fact, I'd like one right now, but you guys frown on that, so I'm not going to take one till later. So they thought it would be a good idea to watch the Jew play volleyball on Ativan, and I broke my ankle in two places, and then they thought, and I thought, oh God, this is a great life I'm starting, and then they said we're going to a place called the Log Cabin, and I thought, cool, pancakes, this is like a civilized group, I can do this. And you got to understand, I put on my best outfit at the time. It was a Monday morning, it was 7 o'clock, I put on my best outfit at the time. It was a purple and gold striped shirt, it was gold MC Hammer harem pants. I weighed 235 pounds, I had the San Fernando Valley crystal meth speed drummer's mullet, I had a big bushy beard, and they put me in a wheelchair and they wheeled me down Beverly Boulevard and up Robertson Avenue at 7 o'clock in the morning, and they carried me up these three steps and they pushed me way over in the corner. How they knew I was a newcomer, I have no idea. But they did, and they gave me a cup of coffee, and they said, would you like to come back tomorrow? And I said, you ass, I have to come back tomorrow. I'm in the freaking hospital down the street. I have to come here every day. Stop spitting on me. And I went back to the cabin every day for 30 days, and I heard everything you guys had to say, and I felt so alone, and here's how psychotic I was. I believed that you guys all got together before I arrived in the morning and talked about how great your life was, and that you all had, like, it was like this big kumbaya group, and I was the outlier. I was the only one that didn't fit in, and this thing couldn't work for me. And after 30 days in the hospital, we had this beautiful coining ceremony. They passed around a coin, and oh, Danny, we love you, and oh, Danny, you're the best, and oh, Danny, you'll be president of AA, and all of this really cool stuff. And I took the coin, and I put it in my pocket, and I got my car, and I went to Lee's liquor store, and I bought 2/5 of vodka, and I went home and started drinking again. Talks about me in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The difference between the alcoholic and the heavy drinker is the heavy drinker, given sufficient reason to stop, stops. Right? The heavy drinker stops. I had an atrial fibrillation of my heart. I had a distended liver. I was told I was going to drink. If I drink, I'm going to die. And I cannot break that cycle of spree and remorse. I cannot stop drinking left to my own devices, no matter how hard I try. And it's not because I'm a bad guy, and it's not because I'm a weak guy, and it's not because any of that. It's because I'm a sick, dying man, right? And I cannot stop drinking. And 3 days later, my mom and my baby sister came to pick me up and take me back to the chemical dependence unit. And I was standing on the front porch of my house on my crutches with a half-drunk bottle of vodka in an overnight bag. And they came to take their son and their big brother back. And that look that I saw in their eyes in that moment is a look that I haven't had to see in anybody's eyes in over 27 years. So when Hillary says, can you come down here on a Sunday night at 7 o'clock? The answer is, you bet your freaking ass I can. Because I never want to forget what those eyes looked like in that moment, April 23rd, 1990. And if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, here's what I can promise you, is that if you treat this like a real piece of business and keep it right here in front of you at all times, you never have to see those eyes again. And if that's as good as Alcoholics Anonymous gets, I can't pay you back in freaking lifetimes. And what happened for me is I got busy. I got a sponsor. He'd never worked a step. I've never worked a step. We were perfect together. And I called him. And I called him every morning, and I said, "Hi, Bob, it's Danny." He said, "Hi, Danny, I love you. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Call me tomorrow." And I called him every day for 6 months, and he didn't drink, and I didn't drink. And then it was time to get another sponsor, and we got busy working the steps as he saw them. He gave me, like, some handouts and some pamphlets and some things to fill out and all kinds of crap. And we know, and I'm not judging it, because he didn't drink, and I didn't drink the whole time we were working the steps that way. It worked fine in that moment, and I knew no different. And we got to the ninth step, and I went to the cemetery to make amends to my dad and my brother and my grandpa, and we sat and we had a talk, and I walked out of there, and it felt kind of hollow to me, like it didn't, and you tell me that for this experience to have a lasting effect, it must have depth and weight, and that didn't have depth and weight to me, so I came back to my group, and I said, what do I do? Am I doing it? One more time, I'm the loser, right? One more time, I'm doing it wrong. You guys do it all right. I'm screwed it up again. And because self-pity is like a warm blanket, I really enjoy it. And what you said to me is just show up and do your job in Alcoholics Anonymous. You'll know when you're clean with your dad. Just show up and do your job. And my first sponsor, Bob, got really sick with AIDS. And I went to the hospital every day, and I held his hand, and I rubbed his forehead, and I changed whatever needed changing. And I didn't do it because I'm a good guy, because I'm not a good guy. I'm a selfish guy. But I did it because that's my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when he died, they asked me to talk at his funeral. And this is, like, talking is not my deal. I'm really good one-on-one. Let's open the book, read chapter 5, get on our knees, hold hands, do the third step. Like, that's my passion. But I talked at his funeral, and I sat down, and I went, oh, I'm a little cleaner with my pop. You know, I'm a little cleaner with my brother. I'm a little cleaner. So this is what you meant by doing my job in AA. So I just got busy doing my job in AA. As you can imagine, with the mullet, the 235 pounds, and the MC Hammer harem pants, I wasn't getting a lot of action. There was not a lot of activity happening in my world. And I have two dating skills. Stalking and snubbing. That's it. Like, that's all I got in my arsenal, right? And so I stalked this girl at my morning meeting, and I didn't have the courage. She was a hairdresser, and I had a mullet, and I thought, we'd be really good together. And I didn't have the courage to ask her out, because I hadn't done a sexual inventory, and I had no idea what self-esteem was like, and I had no idea how to be a sober adult dating male on the planet. I had none of that. So I made a hair appointment. I figured in 1 hour of uninterrupted time, I could con her into going out with me. So I called her up, or I made a hair appointment, I went in, I asked her out, she said yes. We had a great date on them. It was like that whirlwind Monday night, beautiful AA date. It was awesome. It was like stars and blah. It was amazing. So Tuesday morning, I called her 30 or 40 times, and I left like the cards on her doorstep and the flowers on her car because I didn't want her to forget about me. And Wednesday, I did the same thing. And Thursday, I called 30 more times because I didn't want her to forget about me. And on Friday, she dumped me. Because I was freaking crazy. Like, I was nuts. And I went back to my sponsor. He said, you know, just do your job in AA, dude. Maybe you're not ready to date. What he said at the time was, you are definitely not ready to date. But I softened the blow a little bit. So I got busy doing stuff in AA, and she and I ended up going out again, and I was learning how to date, and we ended up moving in together. And right after we moved in together, she said she wanted to go to Hawaii with a friend of hers. And I'm really insecure, and I have really low self-esteem, and I have no tools to communicate that to a partner. Like, I don't know how to say that scares me, so I get retaliatory. And I called my sponsor, and I said, she wants to go to Hawaii. I'm convinced she wants to go to Hawaii to have sex with the Hawaiian military, all of them. Because that's how my brain works, right? That's how I work. And so I called my sponsor, and I said, what do I do? He said, I'm going to tell you exactly what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous with a situation like that. I said, great, I need some direction. I'm willing to follow your direction. Tell me what to do. He said, here's what you do. You go home, and you look her in the eye, and you say, if you choose to go to Hawaii with your friend, I'm going to pack your bags, and I'm going to throw your ass out in the street. And I thought, okay, it sounds a little harsh, but I'm a good AA soldier, and I'm going to do this. And then I made the biggest mistake I'd ever made. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't suggest you try this alone, but I opened the big book to page 69, where it says, now about sex. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. Counsel with others is often quite helpful, but we don't want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. Which means, you know, and if I take that information with the information I get at the beginning of chapter 5, at the beginning of step 3, which is, for any of this to work, first of all, we had to quit playing God. So if I quit playing God and I have no opinion on what's right for you, I'm like, his direction makes no sense. And then there's that line in chapter 5, we stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. And I got on my knees and I said, Pop, I need your help. Just help. And I married her. We've been married 21 years. And I called a guy that I had heard talk in Alcoholics Anonymous, a guy named Scott Redman. And I called him up and I said, I need help. And he said, honey, I can help you. And he could. Then I went over to his house, and we opened the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous to chapter 5, and I always get emotional when I talk about him because I miss him. We opened the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous to chapter 5, and we got on our knees, and we held hands, and we said the third step. We read the third step prayer with one another. He didn't pray it at me. He didn't ask me to memorize anything. It wasn't a sponsor to a sponsee or a baby to a whatever the freak it is. It was one alcoholic holding hands with another alcoholic, inviting God to come into the solution so that we can find out what's next. And then he introduced me to the inventory process as it's outlined in the big book, resentment, fear, and sexual misconduct. Three areas of my life where alcoholism manifests itself the most, where if I treat it like a real piece of business as it's outlined in the big book, I have an opportunity to get free from the resentment so that I can go live a life that was unimaginable to me when I got here. Resentment's the number one offender. It has the power to actually kill. Right? So we can't wish this away any more than we could alcohol. It talks about resentments being mastered, but how? Right? The grouch and the brainstorm, dubious luxury of normal men. So let's say I'm resentful at my wife. What's the cause? She's behaving like herself. And it's incredibly inconvenient for me when she does that. What does it affect in me? And this is the truth, right? I use this example often because I write this 10th step often. I'm resentful of my wife because she's behaving like herself. What does it affect in me? It affects my self-esteem. I've married beneath me. It affects my pocketbook. It's costing me a lot of money. It affects my personal relations because I'm willing to gossip or assassinate her character to anyone who will listen. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, my ambition. It makes me want to be less of a good husband. And it affects my sexual relations because I start withholding all of this from her. And then it says, but the resentment's mine, right? She's done nothing. All she did was wake up and say good morning, right? I got alcoholism. It does, it talks about the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, which means that you don't have to have really done something to me. I just have to think you did, right? And I'm a great mind reader, and I can read your mind behind your back. Like, I know what you're thinking. So if the wrongdoings of others fancied or real, and if you had to really do nothing, then the resentment must be my alcoholism, right? So it tells me we disregard the other person entirely. The resentment's mine. We resolutely look for our own mistakes. What are my defects of character that if God were to remove, the resentment would be lifted? I'd like my wife lifted. I need the resentment lifted. So I'm grandiose. I'm punitive. I'm retaliatory. I'm judgmental. I've got low self-esteem. I'm filled with self-pity. I've got false pride. And my favorite, I'm 27 years sober. She's only 26 years sober, so I'm much closer to God than she is, and I do AA much better than she does. And you're laughing, but that's how I think, right? That's the alcoholic thinking, and I got two choices. I can either treat it or I can punish her. I choose to treat my alcoholism, right? She doesn't even need to know this is going on. And I put that down on paper, and I read it to another guy, and I get on my knees, and then the third step prayer, and then the seventh step prayer. I love the third step prayer where it says, take away my difficulties. And in this case, I go, take away my difficulties with grandiosity, punishment, retaliation, people pleasing, spiritual pride and false pride. But take away my difficulties so that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help. It's not take away my difficulties so I can have a better day. And the beautiful part about the seven step prayer is when I ask you to have all of me, good and bad, it means that it's the whole package, right? I didn't get sainthood when I got sober. What I got is the opportunity to treat it and invite this higher power in to help me navigate it. And where it says, take all of me, good and bad, and remove the things in me that stand in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. None of the A is not a self-help deal for me. A is about being free so that I can show a new guy that this thing works. And then the fear part of the inventory, helped change my life. And I, the short version of the story is I found someone that I owed a huge financial amends to right before my daughter was born, and I made the financial amends, and she cashed a series of checks that were post-dated till I was 90 the day we were checking into the hospital to have my daughter, and I was scared to death. And we got into the hospital in the labor delivery room, and Cindy's in labor, and I'm scared. And what's happening is the fear is taking me out of the experience, right? I'm way up here while this beautiful thing is happening here. And I went in the hallway at 3 o'clock in the morning. I wrote, I'm afraid of being a dad. I'm afraid I'm going to be a horrible dad. I'm afraid I can't afford to be a dad. I'm afraid I'm going to abuse this unborn child. I'm afraid I'm going to split before the baby's born because I'm a cut and run kind of guy. I'm afraid I can't do this. I'm afraid that I'm ill-equipped to be a dad. And I called Scott at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I read him the fear inventory, and I did exactly what it says on page 68 as I got on my knees in the hall of Cedars-Sinai and said, dear God, please remove my fear of being a horrible dad and direct my attention to what you would have me be. And I can tell you 16 years into this deal, I'm a great freaking dad. And I'm a great freaking dad because I don't punish my kid for my alcoholism. I treat it like a real piece of business in Alcoholics Anonymous so that I can learn how to be a dad of a 16-year-old. Oy, oy, man. And then the sexual part of the inventory, where am I selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Everywhere. Do I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Only if I open my mouth. Who did I hurt? Probably you, probably me, maybe some farm animals, I don't remember. Where was I at fault? What are my defects? What are my defects that are at work here? If the sexual part of my inventory is again treating with my alcoholism in how I date or how I have any kind of relationship on the planet, where am I? You know, am I selfish? Am I self-centered? Am I self-seeking? Am I grandiose? Am I a bully? Am I dishonest? Do I lie to you to get something I want? What are all those things that are going on here that if God were to remove, I could learn? And then the most beautiful part of the sexual inventory is the bottom of the page where it said, which is the last question, is what should I have done instead, right? Who's the guy I want to be? Who's the guy I want to grow up to be? Who's my lofty goal? Who's my ideal of, you know, I'm married 21 years. I don't know how to be married 21 years. There's no rule book on guidebook on how to do this. And where I get into trouble like in anything else is when I think I'm supposed to know the answer. So, and then the bottom of page 69 where it says, in this way we help shape a sane and sound ideal for a future sex life. The right answers will come if we want them. So all of a sudden I now have this design, this blueprint of my alcoholism. Because before the inventory, I went through the motions of prayer and I went through the motions of engaging a higher power, but I had no practical sober living experience with that. But once I have this blueprint, this notebook filled with this information about what runs me and what controls me and who I am and how I behave, I can then start in the six and seven step to engage this dialogue with this higher power that I'm at least willing to believe in and say, Pop, I need your help. I can't do this. Can you help me? Can you do this? And I still find that when I get into the most trouble is when I think I'm supposed to know how to do this. When I'm unwilling to ask how to do this, but when I think I know. A couple years ago, my wife got diagnosed with cancer, and she's fine. She's clean. And it was really scary. And I had to say to my, we had to tell our then 13-year-old daughter that her mom had cancer. And like my daughter, I said, Pumpkin, we got to sit down and talk. And we told her what it was, and she goes, Dad, again, you're way oversharing. You're way oversharing. I get it. She's got cancer. It's treatable. She'll be fine. Let's move on. And I'm like, so I asked her to sponsor me because she's got a far clearer perspective on things. I also learned that it's a generational thing, that when I hear cancer, I hear death sentence. When she hears cancer, she hears, let's treat it. Let's move on. So, the day of the first infusion, we're in the hospital and Cindy's getting hooked up to all the drugs and getting ready to drop all this poison into her system. And I'm freaked out, but I can't run, and I go in the bathroom and I go and to my car and I write a fear inventory and I go in the bathroom and I read it to someone. I get on my knees and go, Dear God, please remove my fear of my wife dying of cancer and direct my attention to what you would have me be, right? So I didn't miss a minute, right? I'm there the whole time. I'm doing my job no matter how much I don't want to do that job, because I really don't want to do that job. And so my daughter, 16, a couple years ago, she needed to have a conversation with me about something very private and very personal, and she did it via text, right? So my knee-jerk reaction is, I'm going to kill you, and we're going to have, and so I immediately want to call her, right? She texts, she prefers to text, and I want to call and go, what the f-? And I, restraint of pen and phone, I took a deep breath, and I responded in text, hey babe, do you have a minute? And she said, not now. She's still grounded, but so I waited another minute and then I called her and I said, hey babe, I got the information that you texted me. Do you feel like talking about this? And she said, no Dad, I really don't. There's really nothing to talk about. I gave you the information. And I said to her, I appreciate your willingness to trust and confide in me. I love you as much now as I did before I got that information. Nothing you can say or do will ever change the amount of love I have for you, and I have your back the whole time. And that's not me, right? I need to control her, right? I need her to be a certain way in order for me to know how to navigate my life. And she's a great freaking kid, right? She's a great freaking kid because I want to stay out of the way and see. So the information I got, I had to get on my knees and remind myself that if God's powerful enough in my life to hand in my third step, if I turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him, then I've got to have that unshakable faith that my daughter has a higher power that she can seek and that will protect her the same way I'm safe and protected. And I will tell this story because I have to tell this story. When she was 8 or 9, we had a goldfish named Edie that had been with us forever. And I came home from work and Edie the goldfish was dead. And I had to go into her room and I said, Pumpkin, Edie the goldfish is dead. what should we do? And I told her, because when I was a kid growing up, we had a family pet. My mom didn't tell me he died for a decade, and I didn't want to be that dad. So I went in and said, Pumpkin, what should we do? Edie's dead. And she thought for a minute, and she said, you know, Pop, I think we should take Edie to the ocean and release her back to where she came from. And I thought, that's really sweet, but we live in the valley, and it's 8 o'clock at night, and I want to be a good dad, but not a great dad. And I said, can you come up with something else? And she said, you know, she had to be younger. She had to be 6. She said, yeah, Pop, we can flush her down the toilet because eventually she'll end up in the ocean. And I thought, this is so cool. So my wife, Cindy, grabbed Ruby, and I grabbed the fish, and I plopped her in the tank. And I said, Pumpkin, is there anything you want to say before we say goodbye? And she thought for a minute, and she said, dear God, thank you for allowing Edie to be with our family this long. Now please gently take her home to hers. And that's how Alcoholics Anonymous works in my house, right? That's not my doing. It's not my wife's doing. It's your doing, right? It's the men that I sponsor. It's the women my wife sponsors. It's her sponsor. It's my sponsor. It's you guys coming over and hanging out. And my daughter watching. Never being taught anything, never being told to do anything, but just watching and observing. So about a while ago, my sponsor Scott was really sick with cancer, and he was getting ready to take his light into another room, and I have no clue how to deal with this. None whatsoever. And I'm ill-equipped and I'm unequipped, and we're hanging out in the hospital, and I went in to say goodbye. It was about an hour before he left, and I'm holding his hand and I'm kissing his forehead and I'm wishing him everything, and I don't know what to say because words are inappropriate and words aren't coming to me. And Ruby's prayer pops into my head. Dear God, thank you for allowing Scotty to be with us this long. Now please gently take him home. And 3 years ago, my mom was at St. Joe's Hospital, and she was getting ready to go. And I can't do this. Like, I can't. I don't want to be the grown-up. I want you to be the grown-up. I want to be the kid. I want to pretend this isn't happening. I want to disappear. And I'm holding her hand, and I'm being a son, and I'm kissing her forehead, and I'm using Ruby's prayer. Dear God, thank you for allowing my mom to be with me this long. Now please gently take her home. And what happens for me is, if I don't treat alcoholism like a real piece of business right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, safe and protected, I miss that moment. And I'm absolutely unwilling to allow alcoholism to take me out. So if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to welcome you. I don't know what you're bringing to us, and I don't know what you got, but I can promise you that if you treat this thing right here in front of you at all times, you don't have to miss whatever's coming up for you either. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome home. Thank you.